Okie doke, the book of Esther. The subject of this whole book is the providence of God in the life of Israel never changes. And the providence of God is what we're going to hammer home tonight. We know that nothing happens accidentally. Everything is in the hand of God, and His providence maintains and controls. And I open with an illustration. Even when Israel ignored God over their years of history, God never gave up on them. And the story of Esther is proof that God always is in control of everything, especially with His people, the Jew. Even though the name of God does not appear in this book anywhere, there's no doubt that it was intended to be placed in the canon, the 66 books of the Bible, even though God's name does not appear in it anywhere. And the writer of the book of Esther is not mentioned. We don't know who wrote it, but we're speculating maybe Mordecai, who would have been Esther's uncle. Well, some renderings say he was her uncle. Some renderings say he was her cousin. And I'm not going to split hairs on cousins, second cousins twice removed, or any of that stuff. All we know is he was related to Esther in the days following the 70-year Babylonian captivity. That's the setting, the stage of this book is following the 70-year Babylonian captivity. And I'll get into that more here in a few minutes. Just as God providentially moved the entire world through a taxation by a wicked king in order to get a young pregnant girl from Galilee to Bethlehem so she could have a baby in that city, and providentially, young Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers so that the time to come, Jacob and his family would move from Canaan to Egypt, where ultimately Israel would become captives in the land 400 years. Providentially, this happened at God moving the chess pieces around the board because He knew what He wanted to have done. And through the providence of God, both with Mary being having the baby born in Bethlehem, that was prophetic. It had to happen because God said the Messiah is going to be born in Bethlehem, the city of David. So here she is up in Nazareth, 90 miles away, pregnant, and here comes a tax by a wicked king that says, everybody go back to your land where you were born, and I'm going to take a census and tax you. That was the providence of God. His hand was on them. Same with Joseph. Now, at the time of this story with Esther, the nation of Midian and the nation of Persia were co-world powers. It was called the Medo-Persian Empire. The Medo-Persians beat the Babylonians. In other words, the Babylonians were it started out with the Assyrians. They were the world powers. Then the Babylonians came into power, and that was during the time of the captivity. Then, after the captivity, the Medo-Persian Empire came in, and there was a king named Cyrus, who was a Mede, and he put out a decree that any of the Jews that wanted to go home out of this Babylonian captivity, bye-bye, go, you're free to go. They didn't want to. They had gotten comfortable in Babylon. They had gotten some nice bi-levels and tri-levels and gotten the latest Ferrari and all of those luxuries that were taking place in those days because, man, there was money to burn in that country. They didn't want to go home. So only probably a fraction of them went home. And in this case, Esther didn't go to Babylon or to Israel, Palestine, because her uncle, who was her caregiver, didn't want to go. And there's a whole lot more to that because the providence of God had His hand on the nation of Israel, and Mordecai didn't know it. Esther didn't know it, and even King Xerxes didn't know it. All of this stuff is in the book of Esther, and as you dig to the nuggets of the providence of God in this book, you cannot help but believe that God's hand is, there are no accidents with God. He knows what's going on. Now, the setting again of Esther is, following the 70-year Babylonian captivity, Cyrus permitted the Jews to go back to Jerusalem, but as it turned out, they didn't want to go, and Esther was probably an orphan. Her parents had probably died. This is speculation by some scholars much smarter than me, that she probably, her parents died, and her uncle or cousin, whichever he was, Mordecai, raised her. Now, she is the key player in stopping this massacre that was going to take place down the road, but we don't even bring her into the picture from that until the end of chapter 1 tonight. But after that happens, then there's a plot to kill the king, and there's a Mordecai overhears the plot. He goes and tells the king, and the king stops the plot, and then they ferret out the ones that were doing the plotting, and the plot thickens, as it were. And this time in the life of Israel, God had to have been pulling every string in their life, even though his name is not in this book. God put Esther in Babylon, kept her in Babylon after they could go back to Palestine, because he did not want to have her out of that area when this massacre edict went forward. So, and God also knew that he was going to position Esther to move into being a queen through a beauty contest. Wow. That's what we're going to talk about a little bit tonight and then next week. But the verse that I think is probably the key verse of this book is in chapter 4, verse 14, when Esther said, and this was during the time that this edict had been brought up about the massacre on the Jews, and Esther and Mordecai talked about her going to Xerxes, who was at the time the king, to speak to him about sparing her people. He didn't even know she was a Jew, and he married her. Of course, he had a harem. It wouldn't have mattered how many, you know, what nationality they were. He probably had 150 women in there anyway. But when he learned that she was a Jew, there's nothing he could legally do about that edict, because there's a verse in this book that says the law and the of the Medes and the Persians cannot be reversed. Once a law has been passed, it cannot change, period, even by the king. So that's where the plot really thickened in this edict. Now, the verse that Esther quoted, she didn't know she was quoting scripture then, but we'll tell her when we see her. Who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such time as this? In other words, the providence of God, his hand is on my people, and who knows but what I am here in this land because of this such time as this, which is a reflection of the edict to massacre the Jews. When Pastor gets to chapter 4, I'm sure he's going to devour that, okay? All right, I've entitled this message, A King Throws a Providential Banquet. And here's where it starts, verse 1. Now, in the days of Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia. Now think about that, from India to Ethiopia. That's just a little bit of turf. I mean, that's a third of the world in his kingdom. He had 127 provinces. And in those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Shusha, which was the capital of Babylon at the time. In the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and the pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days, 6 months. And when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Shusha, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting 7 days on top of the 6 months that he had just talked about. The 180 days, that was just the warm-up. The last 7 days is when it really got hot and heavy. All right, now, go on to say, there were, in verse 6, there were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened in the courts from the fine linen and purple and to silver rods, marble pillars and couches of gold and silver and mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble and mother of pearl and precious stones. Drinks were served in the golden vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavish according to the bounty of the king. This was one blast. He was pulling out all the stops, but there was a method to his madness. For the king had given orders to all his staff to in the palace to do as each man desired, and Queen Vashti, which was the lady he was married to, also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. Now on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry, in other words, he was plowed, with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Bitsa, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abaka, Zephar, and Kerkok, I think that's how you pronounce those, the seven eunuchs who served the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown, in order to show the people the princess and her beauty. She was a knockout. She was a looker. He was balmed, and he wanted to let everybody know he was married to the most beautiful girl in the land, and he was going to show her off. Well, she really put a cog in that wheel, because it goes on to say, but Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuch. She says, honey, I don't think so. We're partying over here. You're partying over there. Uh-uh. I'm not coming to your party. I'm staying with my women. Now, there's more to that that I'll get into here in a minute, okay? Now, then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in the law and judgment. The men next to him being, and I'm going to go through those five, seven names again, seven princes of Persia and Media who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. Now, according to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti because she had not performed the command of the king Ahasuerus, delivered by the eunuchs, and Memcan said to the in the presence of the king and officials, not only against the king has the queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the people who are in the province of King Ahasuerus. In other words, hey, look, now this is getting personal. She's refused to come at your beck and call, and if she gets away with that, then our wives are going to say, hey, we don't have to listen to you, Jack. The queen didn't have to listen to the king, so we ain't listening to you. So they were threatened. That's literally what happened here. They were afraid that they were going to lose their crown in their homes, and they didn't want any part of that. So he's got people from 127 provinces here in this big bash, so they put their heads together and have a powwow, and they're going to put a plan together to make sure that Vashti doesn't get away with this and that they can go home and still be in control of their wives. That was the big deal, that they can tell their wives what to do, because the women's lib back in those days was probably going to get pretty strong if they could do anything they wanted to do at the king's beck and call. All right, now, verse 15. According to the law, what was to be done to Queen Vashti because she had not performed the command of the king. I'm repeating. Let's go to 17. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women. In other words, our wives are going to get that word, and they're going to just jump all over it. Causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she didn't come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. If it please the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be repealed or can't be reversed, that Vashti is never again to come before the king, Ahasuerus, and let the king give her a royal position, give her royal position to another who is better than she. Again, the providence of God, his hand is on this, because through this edict, there had to be a replacement for Vashti, because tucked into this edict was a bill of divorcement. He was going to divorce the woman. And if he was going to divorce her, king can't be without a queen. So, next thing happens, the beauty contest pops up. Here we go. This advice pleased the king and the princess, and the king did as Mucum proposed, and he sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in his own script, and to every people in all their own language, that every man must be the master of his own household and speak according to the language of his people. Now, that was a whirlwind through the chapter. I want to go back and do some verse-by-verse stuff now, because as we do this, I want you to be thinking the providence of God. His hand is on this book, this situation, at this time, and he is moving the players to where he wants to move them in order to ultimately save the nation of Israel when another guy comes along and writes an edict that cannot be reversed by the Medes and the Persians once it's set in law. This book is so God-filled, it's amazing at his hand being on the nation of Israel. All right, verse 1. When we talk about in the days of Ahasuerus, Ahasuerus is a title. That's not his name. It's a title. And the man who is the Ahasuerus at this time, his name was Xerxes. Now, Ahasuerus would be much like Caesar. In later on, you know, Caesar, Harold, Caesar, whomever it might have been, or in the dynasty of the Herods, you had Herod Agrippa, you had Herod the Great, there were four Harolds, Harold Philip, and there were four of them. Anyway, the Herald was the title, and the name after the title was who the individual was. So Ahasuerus was the title of King Xerxes at this point in time, okay? And there were several Xerxes also. There was Artaxerxes, there was Xerxes, there was Xerxes the Third. So, you know, it was a line of succession in the family that was keeping the name, but the title is what we're looking at here, okay? J. Vernon McGee suggests that this Xerxes was Xerxes the Great, okay? So that would have been in the line of the Xerxes and the Artaxerxes and all those Greek names or whatever they were, stem from Xerxes the Great. Now, verses 2 and 3 says that in the third year he gave a feast for all the officials. And as we've said, this was one serious feast. 180 days. McGee suggests that there was a 1 to 2,000 people there for 6 months partying all day long. And there was a reason that he threw the party. He was greedy. He wanted more than just from India all the way across the world. He wanted to have more. So he was going to wage a war against Greece. Greece was the upcoming power in the background. See, we had Assyria, and then we've had the Babylonians. Now we've got the Medo-Persians, and coming in behind the Medo-Persians was the Greeks. Now, if we look in Daniel, we'll see that Daniel talked all about this in his book, in the book of Daniel, when we talked about the nations, four great nations that were going to come to power, and he named them as being the Babylonians, the Medo-Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans. And ultimately, the Romans were the ones that were in power when Christ was born and all of that. Now, as we see this lay of the land, God had told Daniel already who was coming into power next. And the Greeks were going to come into power, but Xerxes didn't know that God had already put his stamp of approval on that. So here's what he does. He says, okay, I'm going to get myself in a position that I'm going to be proactive. And I'm going to go to war against these Greeks before they can raise up and knock me off my throne. So that was his plan. Okay? Well, the plan was good, but the best laid plans of mice and men, as the saying goes, can never be counted on to be something that will come to be. So, he brings all of these people in to his palace and wines and dines them to show them, number one, that financially he is solvent. I can throw this party that can last 6 months and feed you and let you get drunk and all the things that's going to happen to show you I have the power, I have the money, I have the authority that I can knock these Greeks right out. And that was the purpose of this party that he had thrown. Well, little did he know that as he got into this thing, that he was going to get a little bit of resistance because the people throughout the land, they were listening to what he was saying, and he was trying to sucker them into a war, but the hand of God would not ultimately let him do that, and we'll see that here just in a moment. He wanted his rulers and princes to see that he was able to pay for the war and financially solve it, and that the feast was his way of demonstrating all of his glory, might, and power. Well, in verse 5, when these days were completed, we're now coming down to the last week of this raging party. Ahasuerus saw the gang was getting tired of partying by now, so he plans this one last bash that was going to end the 6 months festival. For that last week, he took them to his rooftop ballroom and wined and dined and just let them party to their heart's content. And that was not uncommon in any of the kingdoms back then, that they partied a lot. But in this case, he was trying to prove a point. His point was, and they didn't even realize that they were being set up. His point was, I want your money. And I want to sponsor this war with your money. And I want the soldiers in your provinces to join my army so we can go against these Greeks. And that way, I am going to be the world-dominating force. That's what that was all about. But you know, it was the providence of God that he saw what was happening here, and basically God was saying, you're not gonna change my program. And when a battle came up, it was a battle. I think I've got it written down here. Let me see if I can find it. Well, I'll come to it as we get into my notes. I can't find it right now. Anyway, when this party comes down to the last day, everybody's bombed, and Ahasuerus wants everybody to see his beautiful wife. One commentator said, probably, and this is speculation, that he wanted her to come out nude so that he could parade her in front of all the men. They were all bombed anyway. They didn't care. And this is the way they partied. The men partied here, and the women partied there. And the men, they didn't want to mix business with pleasure, so they would have their business part away from the women, and then they would have their party part where the wives couldn't check on them while they were in here with these women. I mean, it had nothing's changed. I mean, that's the way it is in the political world. It's the way it is with anything that where there's drinking involved. And McGee, I love him. He hates alcohol. Every time there's anything that I've studied under him where alcohol has been involved, he gets on a rabbit trail about all the horrible things of alcohol. I think his father might have been an alcoholic. I'm not sure. Yeah. But anyway, he was saying, okay, we got everybody drunk. He has Vashti to come out, and she refuses because she doesn't want to come out and striptease or whatever it might have been. So when this happens at this point in time, the guys see that this man that's trying to sell them on going into a big fight with the Greeks, he can't even control his wife. Come on, what kind of leader is this? That he wants his wife to come out, and yet he wants us to go into battle for him? I don't think so. Well, he's got egg all over his face. Somehow, he's got to get out of this. And he has to make it sound like that he's in total control, but he's got these noblemen and these princes from all these provinces that are here partying with him, and they have enough influence to say, Ahasuerus, King Xerxes, we need to talk about this, so let's have a leadership team meeting. Okay? We're going to take time out, we're going to have a meeting, and we're going to set a strategy, and as we set this strategy, we're going to have to come up with something that's a two-edged sword. Number one, that you get us out of hot water with our wives. And number two, that you come up with a plan that will not violate the law of the Medes and the Persians, because it cannot be renounced once it's been stamped even by the king. All right, but here we go. The party has come to a crashing halt, and Xerxes is embarrassed. He's mad. And he's got a safe face. So, verse 12, we see when Vashti refused, it says, Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, delivered by the eunuchs. And at this, the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. Then the king said to his wise men, all of these guys in the 127 provinces, who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in the law, and there were some lawyers there, no doubt, and judges. And the men next to him, these five funny-sounding names, who saw the king's face, sat first in the kingdom, that said, according to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti, because she has not performed the command of the king, delivered by the eunuchs, then this spokesman guy, Memucan, said to the in the presence of the king, not only against the king has the queen done wrong, but also against the officials and all the people who are in the provinces of the king of Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt. So this is the new problem that comes up. According to the law, at this time, they did not have an existing law that could counter what was taking place. So what do? Okay, we make a new law. Well, that sounds familiar. Sounds like some things we've seen happen just very recently in our country. Well, let's just make up a new law, make it work. And that's kind of what they were going to do at this leadership team meeting that they were having. So, in 19, if it pleased the king, a royal order be written in verse 19 that the laws of Medes and Persians may not be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before the king, and the king give her a royal position, give her royal position to another who is better than she. Now, we're fast forwarding just a little bit from here, because the plot that goes against Xerxes here in the next chapter is setting the ground for getting Mordecai, Esther's uncle, getting him in some kind of a place of authority, because he overhears the plot against Xerxes and tells the soldiers there's a plot against the king. So they ferret out the plot, they find the guys that did it, and they take care of business. So Mordecai comes into prominence in the nation of Persia as a Jew. Now, I don't know, I haven't read anything that says how Xerxes felt about the Jews. I mean, obviously he knew that they were Jews because they had been in captivity for 70 years. And he knew all about that from history. But ultimately, they are now given freedom and liberty to go home, and they don't want to go because they like the lifestyle. Businessmen, businesses flourishing, and a lot of corn in the barn and things that, you know, they just didn't want to leave. Now, the suggestion by the leadership team is, okay, Xerxes, here's what you do. First off, you divorce that woman. Get her clear out of your palace, because she is bad news. She thinks she's really hot stuff. And she defied you in front of all of us. Even though we were just a little bit looped, we understood that she was defying your order. And if you're going to lead us into a fight, we want you to have nerve enough, spine enough, backbone enough to take us into the fight as the man we look up to. Right now, Jack, we can't look up to you. You're a wimp. That's a pretty loose paraphrase. But that is kind of the context of what's taking place here. So, he says, let the king give her royal position to another, and this is where the providence of God comes in. God knew who that other was going to be. It was an orphan girl that had lived in the latter part of the Babylonian captivity. She'd probably be just a young lady, 20 maybe, I'm just guessing. So, the captivity had been going on 50 years, but now, when she's born, and then, as the captivity, the world powers change from the Babylonians to the Medo-Persians, then there's more time that passes. So, in the time frame of the nation of Israel, one commentator suggested only about a third of the Jews went back to Palestine. Now, we know that Nehemiah led a bunch of them back to fix the wall, and that when he took the ones back with him, he was fighting the people that were living in the land who had taken over the land while the Jews were out of the land in Babylon. See, that's just the way the world works. When they were captured, there were three different captivities. And they were about 10 years apart. The first one took a large number. The second took the ones that were scrawny and not very warlike, and the third one was just old people and kids. They didn't really want them. So in the three times that they came into Palestine to take the Jews out of there, to take them to Babylon, when the land was empty, what happens? Well, the scavengers that are around, they say, hey, man, look at this house. I don't even have to build a house. He's gone. He's not coming back. I'm going to claim this house. And we don't know whether they were Philistines or whether they were any part of the surrounding area, but they just went right in and took over the land. Well, now Cyrus says, okay, y'all, you can go home. So here they come back. And what do they got to do? That guy says, hey, fella, I got squatters' rights here. You've been gone 70 years. You ain't got any right to come and take this house back. And that's where the fight came on with Nehemiah. They were wanting to run them back out of Palestine. So Nehemiah says, okay, the walls are down. We're going to rebuild these walls. And we're going to push these people out of our land because God gave us this land. Genesis 12:2. God told Abraham, I will make you a great nation. And I will those that control you, or those that love you, I will love them. But those that don't love you, I will not love them. But in you, Abraham, will all the nations of the earth be blessed. And how was that going to happen? That was Messiah. The bloodline of Abraham, through him, Messiah was coming. So why did God want to protect Palestine? Because that's where his people were going to be when Messiah was born 400 years down the road. Now, we still got 400 years to go from here to the time that Jesus is born. But God was setting the stage. And when the Greeks came in, when the Greeks took over from the fight that the Medo-Persians threw up against them, God knew that Alexander the Great and all of those big leaders of the Greek nation were going to ultimately give them occupancy in that land. And then when the Romans took it over, hey, it was pretty much a piece of cake. The Romans didn't care what those Jews did as long as they weren't making any trouble. They could care less. Just don't come to Rome with a courier saying there's trouble down in Jerusalem. Because if there is, I'm going to send my soldiers in there and there's going to be heads getting lopped off. So you guys behave and you can worship any god you want to worship. You can have any trade you want to have. You can do anything you want to do in this land. Just don't make any waves. Okay? Now, again, I fast-forwarded 400 years on that last statement. But they bring the picture together. God's hand right here in Shushan the palace, which was the capital of Babylon at the time, God was saying, okay, right here, I am going to make a statement that me, God, the I am that I am, is making the statement, this is my edict that there's a lady that I'm going to put in place of this Vashti, who she probably wasn't that bad of a person. I mean, if he did ask her to do something like that, I mean, I don't blame her saying, hey, But in those days, a woman, her, you know, she didn't have any authority, any voice in anything. But God didn't care about any of that. He was setting the stage for this woman who was an orphan in captivity to come to prominence as the queen of Xerxes. Now again, Pastor is going to get into this somewhere down the road in his study, but I'll give you kind of a foreglimpse of what happened. In those days, when the king was sitting on his throne, in his throne room, if anybody approached him and they didn't have permission, they were dead. if I'm sitting on my throne here and somebody comes in this room and bows down and addresses me and I didn't say it's okay, boom, you're going to get hung. And that's the way it was. You did not approach the king unless he pointed his scepter and says, you can come. And that's what made it so critical when Esther wanted to come to the king to beg him for this massacre that was taking place, because when she came to him, he could have very easily said, hey, lady, I didn't point the scepter at you. Off with her head. Even though she was his queen. That's the way it was in those days. Life was cheap. Okay. Verse 20, so when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, it is vast, all women will be given honor to their husbands, will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. So what they're saying is, we want you to draft this bill so that the women understand that the man has the authority, and once that is approved, it can't be changed. And in this case, Vashti is going to have to be out of here because she has already made the problem that we have. So off with her head. Now, let's see. Built into the law was the divorce, and here's the providence of God is, Esther has come into the story. This is how, in this story, this is how Esther gets in the story, by the replacement of Vashti, and the king, these noblemen, they say, hey, oh king, we got a great idea. Here's how you can get a new queen. Have a beauty contest. All across the land. Anybody that wants to enter the beauty contest can enter it. Now, in those days, when someone was going to be in a beauty contest like this, they kind of cheated because they gave them a whole year to get beautiful. They were able to do their hairstyle, put on their makeup, all the clothes, all the spas, and all the exercises, and all of the things that makes them look good. They would do that for a whole year. They would let them do that. And then the king would say, okay, now I'm ready to pick and choose. And Esther was one that was brought into the spa or whatever it was, and Mordecai was just kind of a backseat driver in these days because he didn't have any real high position of anything, but somehow or another he was still faithful to God. There weren't many that were faithful to God during the Babylonian captivity, because this was a time that God was punishing them for what? Idolatry. For the way they had turned their backs on God. So, during this period of time, there weren't too many real spiritual people. But Mordecai, evidently, God's hand was still on him. Why? The providence of God. He was the man that God wanted to use, and he was going to move all the chess players around to get Mordecai put into a position of prominence. And then when this Purim edict goes out, Mordecai is going to be the one that is the catalyst to have them rewrite a new law, as it were, and send Esther to the king to beg. And Pastor's going to have a ball with this. I know he is. I'm not going to steal all his thunder. This book has got so much about the providence of God in it that you can find almost in every chapter something that God did with his hand for the nation of Israel to move this king or this person or this person to be in the position that he wanted them until the time came that he would say, okay, now's the time to act. And that's exactly what this book is all about. Well, that's kind of gotten us through it tonight, the first chapter. Mordecai is the new key player here. Esther is the new key player. And as we evaluate the key players and see what they do in their respective roles, Mordecai, he must have been a righteous man because God used him. But that doesn't mean that God didn't use unrighteous men. Sometimes he did. But in this case, Mordecai seems to be the superstar coming up. And it's ironic to me that Esther, being his either niece or cousin, whichever the case may be, she still took his advice. She didn't say, "Uncle, hey, I don't need you anymore. I'm doing all right." And by the time she was appointed or chosen as the beauty queen and made the queen of the ball, she still had a respect for her uncle Mordecai. Now, I don't know what it would have been like in those days for somebody to live in a harem. One of my commentators said it was probably a miserable life. All he did was sit around and make himself beautiful, and the king might come in and see him once a year. Or not at all, who knows? So it was a very boring life, and yet they weren't free to do whatever they wanted to do. They had to sit around and look pretty. That would get old, I think, in just a little bit of time. Nothing wrong with looking at a pretty face. But hey, too much of a good thing sometimes isn't good, you know? And that's what was taking place in these harems. Think of Solomon. 900 wives? Or 300 wives and 600 concubines. To make it. That's almost 1,000 women. Hey, he had a problem. But that's the way it was in these countries where there was godlessness, where there was kings ruling that had no love for God, only about Watashi boy, about me. Something about, look at me. I'm going to knock these Greeks back 10 blocks. Because I don't want my Medo-Persian Empire invaded. Well, that didn't work so very well. So, anyway, the conclusion then is, anyone who does not see the hand of God in everything in life is a fool. That was Watashi's statement. Somebody else has probably said it, but I'd definitely say it tonight. There are no accidents which affect the Jewish nation, the church, or the heathen world. God moves things around to meet his purpose because he knows the beginning from the end, and that is called the providence of God. Questions or comments? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's just their mentality. Yeah. You're just a baby machine and you know, slave. That's all. Yeah. Well, that's sad. But
think also about our government, our economy, all going on. And have to come back to God's providence. He puts people where he wants them, brings them up.
Amen. That's the key. If you didn't get anything out of this lesson today, get that. The providence of God is going to last because he's calling the shots. Okay? Let's pray together. Thank you, Father, again, for the introduction to this great book, introduction to a great God. As we see your hand in the life of Israel throughout the time of this rule in Israel and and with foreign nations and them being subject to foreign powers, and yet you were above it all. You were handling and controlling absolutely every step, every day, everywhere. How wonderful it is to trust in a God like that, who can't be thwarted, who can't be sucker punched, who can't have anything that would change His program, because He knows the beginning from the end, and that's our God. Thank you for who you are. Thank you for what you are, and thank you that we can worship you with love and adoration. We pray these things in the wonderful name of your Son. Amen.